It's Sam Cedar introducing whiny ass teeny baby conservatives to the truth. Wow, wow, conservatives, that's you crying. The left just got a little bit louder on the Majority Report.
It is Wednesday, January 26, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District in New York City. Last night was the State of the Union. We will spend most of this program talking about it, although when we have our guest today, Eric Alterman, Professor Eric Alterman, one of the he could be. Well, no. I was going to say he could be one of the most prolific guests that I've had on the radio in my career, but no, not even close. Because, yeah, I would have Atreos on a weekly basis and Marcos on a weekly basis, Marcos Melitzis. He is certainly the rudest guest I have ever had on radio. I think he could be the rudest guest of all, but he is also very brilliant, and I like him very much. It takes a certain je ne sais quoi to eat in the middle of a radio interview. I have attempted to eat while actually doing a radio show, but you need a certain level of confidence or, well, let's just leave it there, to actually eat. Or at one point he ordered a drink when we were at the Aspen Comedy Festival and returned it during the interview, chastised the waitress for bringing him a twist as opposed to a wedge or something of lemon. We're going to get into the State of the Union, but, God. Let's just start with clip number two from Michelle Bachmann, the future of the Republican Party.
I want to thank the Tea Party Express and Tea Party HD for inviting me to speak this evening. I'm here at their request and not to compete with the official Republican remarks. The Tea Party is a dynamic force for good in our national conversation, and it's an honor for me to speak with you.
So, understand what happened last night. I don't know if you saw this, but if you, and gosh, you know, I watched the speech, but I did not hear the speech. And that's not because I had it on mute, because I was so astonished by what I saw. This was so fantastic. So Paul Ryan, this guy who has a farcical economic program, which calls for privatizing Social Security, privatizing Medicare, cuts that are impossible to make and won't be made with budget numbers that don't add up. And I think I had an argument with, well, it's not name drop Friday, but I don't think he's a name. Rahim Salam. Salon, what's that guy's name? The conservative, I don't know, on Parker Spitzer once. And we were coming off, and I was talking about Ryan's numbers are a joke. They don't measure up. And he's like, well, he's agreed that if his numbers don't measure up, he will raise taxes up to 16.9% of GDP, which, of course, is the, and it may not be 16.9%. It's pretty close, which is the magic number that the Cato Institute had. A guy named, gosh, what was that guy's name? I have it.
It's up there.
Yes, I know. I have it up on the wall there, that Cato report. But essentially, he was the former head of the Cato Institute and had realized that Starve the Beast doesn't work. When you cut taxes below a certain percentage of GDP, you actually get more government spending because constituents think they're getting it on the cheap. They don't think they're paying for it. They're putting on a credit card. You know, that's why people tend to spend more if they have a credit card, because they don't have to pay for it right away. And so basically what this guy was saying to me was that, yeah, Ryan's numbers are all a joke, but he'll raise taxes if he has to get up to the point what we need. Well, yeah, of course. That's quite a short circuit you got going there. In other words, we're going to sell the American public a bill of goods, and then we'll raise taxes on them anyways. So he gave the official rebuttal, which guess who's not going to be president ever? Paul Ryan. They're going to have to do a lot of work on him to get him to the point where people trust this guy. But what was really astonishing is that CNN decided to carry Michelle Bachmann's speech ostensibly to, what was it, Tea Party Nation? Tea Party HD, high definition. I'm not sure what it is. Tea Party Express. Who knows how these franchises work. And CNN decided to carry this alt rebuttal, which some people found quite controversial, because the only reason why they did is because they have paired up with Tea Party HD or whatever it is to sponsor a Republican debate. So they were trying to give legitimacy to this organization. I think in the end, it really, really ended up hurting the Republicans, because it split their message. It makes them look non-unified. And they also let perhaps the craziest elected member of their entire caucus. I was going to say the stupidest, but that's a tough competition. I think Bachmann could be the craziest. And, here's a little tip. When you're doing a two-camera shoot, let me rephrase this. Well, I should say this. Michelle Bachmann spent the entire time on her rebuttal that was broadcast on CNN talking into the wrong camera. Do you understand what I'm saying? There was some moron didn't realize, wait, we should share the feed. So they had two cameras. One of the cameras had a teleprompter. How many times have we heard the Republicans talk about Obama's nothing without his teleprompter? Guess what? You ain't going to hear much of that anymore. Because she was looking into the teleprompter and the camera that was meant for the Tea Party HD. But the one that most Americans were watching was just off to her right. And so it was as if you were watching a behind-the-scenes feed. Like, hey, we're doing a documentary on Michelle Bachmann. This is when she was giving that speech. Except for nobody told you that this is when she was giving that speech. You thought that she was giving the speech to you. Except for she was looking about 12 to 18 inches off screen. It was the strangest thing I've ever seen. And I couldn't follow any of it. And God forgive me, I wasn't going to go back and listen to it. But this part got some wowzas from people.
And I believe that America is the indispensable nation of the world. Just the creation of this nation itself was a miracle.
Hold on, pause it for 1 second.
See a miracle again.
Pause it for 1 second. The indispensable nation of the world? I don't even know what that means.
We're too big to fail, I think.
All right, let's play it from the beginning. Turn it up a little bit.
And I believe that America is the indispensable nation of the world.
The nation.
Just the creation of this nation itself was a miracle. Who can say that we won't see a miracle again? The perilous battle that was fought during World War II in the Pacific at Iwo Jima was a battle against all odds. And yet, this picture immortalizes the victory of young GI.
Stop it. Go back. Go back. Go back. This is when somebody, where she's like noticing people behind the camera, and it's hard to talk into a teleprompter. It is. I had very much difficulty. One of the shows I did for Olbermann, I could hear, like, the director talking in the ear of the AD, and it was distracting. I imagine that when it got to the words Iwo Jima, or what is it, Iwo Jima, that's the moment where people are realizing, oh my God, she's looking into the wrong camera. And so they're running back and forth in her eye line, and she's trying to focus. And they're, so, okay, just go back just a little, because I want to hear her say those words again.
That was fought during World War II in the Pacific at Iwo Jima was a battle against all odds. And yet this picture immortalizes the victory of young GIs over the incursion against the Japanese.
Over the
incursion? These six young men raising the flag came to symbolize all of America coming together to beat back a totalitarian aggressor. Our current debt crisis we face today is different, but we still need all of us to pull together. But we can do this. That's our hope. We will push forward. We will proclaim liberty throughout the land. And we will do so because we, the people, will never give up on this great nation.
This just in. Michelle Bachmann, bat shit crazy. Folks, let me tell you something. Those brave young GIs, when they put that flag up at Uma Jamuma, except for the Indian guy, don't think about that guy. Isaac Hayes, a drinking problem. Don't think about him. When they fought the incursion of that totalitarian Japanese peoples, that was really important. Now, becoming a Majority Report member is different. It's different. But we all need to just, it's a miracle that this show exists. It's a miracle. And it's different from Iwo Jima, but at the same time, it isn't. So please, if you can become a Majority Report member, do. And also, just coffee's not like Iwo Jima. It's not at all like, it's different. But even still, if you go to justcoffee.coop and put majority in the coupon code, you'll get 10% back. So just keep that in mind. So Obama, I've got a great piece here by Kevin Baker, which is not available to anybody because I'm on an email list with him. And Kevin just sent me this email. And well, I want to go through that. But there was a couple of things I wanted to talk about with Obama's speech. The most obviously pressing from my perspective was Social Security. And there had been many, 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 many reports that it was on the table where they're going to bring this up, cuts it for Social Security at the State of the Union. And I mentioned yesterday about that Alter. Now Alter and I are going back and forth on email, arguing about life expectancy. It's, oh boy. But here is when Obama brought up Social Security. Did you grab the Social Security one? Did we get that one?
No.
That's the one we don't have. Okay, well, let me read it off to you and tell you what he said about Social Security. Because when we had talked to Digby, Digby had talked about there being two ways to mention Social Security. One is come out with cuts. The other is just to mention it in passing. But Obama found a third way, pun intended. Because the one thing I would say about this speech was that it was really meant to split the difference. And I got to say, I went in with very low expectations. And we'll talk more about this with Alterman, because I actually think that he was not as attacking on liberal ideological pillars as Bill Clinton did back in his State of the Union address when he started his triangulation. He did not say things like, we must shrink government. He said, let's have a five-year freeze. I've cut employees, which that message is somewhat implicit but not explicit. He did the same thing for some liberal ideology in terms of talking about the importance of teachers, talking about the value of regulation. And we'll talk more about that with Alterman. He called for some new infrastructure. Some of this was, you know, it wasn't great. I think Krugman set it up, had a best response. Meh. Meh. But the problem with Social Security in the way that he mentioned it was in its context. The bipartisan, he said, bipartisan fiscal commission I created last year made this crystal clear. I don't agree with all their proposals, but they made important progress. And their conclusion is that the only way to tackle our deficit is to cut excessive spending wherever we find it. In domestic spending, defense spending, healthcare spending, and spending through tax breaks and loopholes. One paragraph away from that. He's talking about still in his deficit section. He says, to put us on solid ground, we should also find a bipartisan solution to strengthen Social Security for future generations. We must do it without putting at risk current retirees, the most vulnerable, or people with disabilities, without slashing benefits for future generations, and without subjecting Americans' guaranteed retirement income to the whims of the stock market. And then he goes on, if we truly care about a deficit, we can't afford a permanent extension of the tax cuts for the wealthy is 2%. Now, this is, there's a lot of inconsistency here. There has been no solution put forth to so-called strengthen Social Security for future generations, short of raising the cap on taxing the wages, that wouldn't actually cut more than Social Security will be forced to cut in terms of benefits if nothing's done at all. In other words, if we do nothing at all, after 2036, our benefits will reduce by 25%. Any suggestion to so-called strengthen Social Security will actually cut benefits by 35% further down the road. These are inconsistent statements. Social Security is already on very strong ground, but if you really want to strengthen it, that has nothing to do with the deficit. There's no reason to put that in there. He talked about cutting excessive spending wherever we find it. What is the definition of excessive? Are people really living lavishly off of Social Security? I don't think so. We'll get into this more of this after we talk to Eric Alterman, who we're going to be talking to in just a moment. So please, stay with us. Back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Professor Eric Alterman. He is a writer for The Nation, The Washington Monthly, The New Republic, Harper's, Le Monde Diplomatique, Vanity Fair, The New York Times Magazine. He's written for The Atlantic Monthly, World Policy Institute, New York, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone Magazine, The Nation. Of course, I mentioned that. He's written for The Daily Beast, San Francisco Chronicle. He is a professor at New York University, Brooklyn College, CUNY. He's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and Media Matters for America. And he is author of his most recent, The Kabuki Democracy, The System versus Barack Obama, Why We're Liberals, What Liberal Media, ISBN number 978-0465-001774. The book on Bush, When Presidents Lie, A Sound and Fury, Ain't No Sin to Be Glad You're Alive, on Bruce Springsteen. I know I must have forgotten some, but Eric Alterman is so prolific that it's impossible. Eric, Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you. What do you got for me?
I am very much enjoying Kabuki Democracy. Let me ask you this. Did you watch the speeches last night?
Actually, I watched Sunday night's Masterpiece Theater last night, and then I watched Big Love.
And so you didn't watch any of the State of the Union or Bachman or Ryan?
I've never watched the State of the Union. Bachman, Ryan, isn't that...
You're thinking of Bachman Turner Overdrive.
Yeah, I was going to make a joke about you ain't seen nothing yet, but I thought, I don't know what the demo of your audience is. If they get early 1970, third-rate Canadian band humor.
I did play
tennis this morning, and on the way I missed my subway, so I read a lot of the newspaper about the speech, so I can pretend I watched it if that's what we need to do here.
Well, we can talk about it a little bit. I mean, I think if you didn't see Michelle Bachman, there's no point in talking about it, because that was one of the most fantastic moments of television I think I've ever seen, frankly.
I was going to write a column about Michelle Bachman today. So
you should watch it, because she accidentally was giving her speech to the wrong camera.
Well, that sounds less wrong than she usually is.
That's a good point. I'm not even...
Less damage than she usually does to the general understanding and knowledge of the world.
that's true. So let's talk, briefly about... let me put it this way. I think Obama's State of the Union... we can tie this into your book. Let's talk about your book, and then we can bring in the State of the Union, because your book is based upon an article that you wrote over, I think it was, or maybe the article was actually an excerpt from the book.
Now, the article came first. The article was 17,000 words, and it was published in The Nation in July. Nation Online, it was too long for The Nation magazine. And also, I don't think my editor liked it that much. And then it got a big response when it came out, although most of the response misread the article. But anyway, it got a lot of attention. And so I got some book offers. And so I turned it into the book, and the book is about, the book's about 200 pages, so it's about 40,000 words. So it's almost three times as long as the original article. But it's got a lot more stuff in it.
Yeah, the book is a great read, and it basically makes the case, and please correct me as I know you will if I'm wrong, or even slightly wrong, not even wrong.
I'm a little shy.
Maybe we should just let you state the case.
No, I'd rather hear it from you.
Well, the case is that there is a systemic problem with our democracy that is contributed to or is consisting. There's a systemic problem with our democracy that is a function of too much money in our politics, of a media that is at best lazy and at worst, I guess, in some ways biased, and an intransigent sort of runaway Republican Party, that these factors make it almost impossible.
Right, and there's also the other factor I would add. I agree with the way you call it. But the other factor I would add would be the structural problems of getting any legislation passed, even with a sort of minority. The ease with which a minority can bollocks up the system.
And all those things have contributed to make it virtually impossible for Obama to pursue an aggressive, progressive legislative agenda.
Well, it's made it impossible. What it's made impossible is for Obama to carry out his campaign promises, even though he had supermajorities in both houses. So if a president of one party is elected and he's got supermajority in both houses of that same party, and he can't pass his legislation that he promised you, then you've had kind of a controlled experiment in whether or not your democracy works. And our democracy failed that system, failed that test.
Now, let me ask you this. Do you think, and I know that you share the frustration that if we move from a legislative perspective, I mean, this you're not making an assessment necessarily of Obama's presidency in that regard. You're making more of an assessment of systemic problems that we have, and I guess it would follow that no matter who was president, they would not be able to get any progressive change enacted under those circumstances.
Yeah, there are some people, and you may be one of them, who think that Obama fooled us in the campaign and that he was really always just a corporate shill, and he fooled the left into thinking that he was a kind of insurgent who shared their frustrations with the fundamental direction of our politics. I don't share that view. I'm not sure it's wrong. There's no way to be sure. I don't know what's in Obama's heart. I've only had one real conversation with him in my life. But I think that a perfectly good example of why that view is likely wrong would rest on two pillars. One is, I think it's credible for Obama and his supporters to say that when they came to power, all the things that they promised turned out to be impossible in terms of transforming the system because the economy was in such dire straits that that was a luxury they could no longer afford. Hemorrhaging 80,000 jobs a week, the Dow down thousands of points and losing hundreds of points, you know, the day he was inaugurated and over 1,000 points a week he was inaugurated. It called for emergency action, and he had to go to war with the economy, with the system you have. So he had to use the system rather than try and clean it up and transform it. And once he used the system, he had to play the game the way it's played, ugly as that may be. That would be one argument. Second argument would be that system is actually impervious to change for the reasons I write about. Number one, because it's supported by the power of money. Number two, because the people who exercise power within it enjoy it that way. And number three, because the media are both so weak and so irresponsible in many respects that there's no way to focus on its failures. You need a short book to do that, which is what I've written. But we don't do that every day. I mean, one reason I wrote this book is because when I watch Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert every morning and I see, oh my God, look what a terrible problem they're making fun of in the media. There's like a million of them. There's a new one every day, and nobody puts it all together and says, gee, the system is screwed. So that's what I try to do.
Now, but one of the things that I mean, there may be some truth to that, and maybe it's possible that...
Maybe some truth to it? There's quite a lot of truth to it.
Well,
I wrote a whole book demonstrating how much truth there is to it.
Well, but the central premise that... that Obama couldn't do what he promised. I mean, because to me, one of the things that Obama promised, as far as I was concerned, was, and I agree that there are handicaps legislatively, but he chose a certain economic team that chose a certain path. And I think that he has actual faith in these guys. And he could have certainly taken a different rhetorical path. Now, maybe he would not have been any more successful legislatively. Certainly not in the short run. But he could have, you know, he promised to be that guy who was going to make it different than 94. He promised also that, you know, he spoke about Reagan. And I presume that when he was talking about Reagan, he wasn't talking about Reagan's policies. He was talking about Reagan's transformative ability as a communicator. And I think the one thing that Obama has not done, and this is where the State of the Union comes in a little bit, is he has not made the case, regardless of his legislative victories or failures, he has not made a full-throated case for the value of government. He has not made a full-throated case for any type of progressive values. Now, you may argue that he was never that guy, and that's possibly true, but I would also say that from a legislative or at least, you know, an executive branch, there are a couple of things that he could have done, you know, like the home mortgage modification, home loan modification program, HAMP. You know, that was completely out of the executive branch. That was money that had already been earmarked. They could have done whatever they wanted to do that, but they followed a path that was very much one that was advantageous for banks, but not for homeowners. And that, you know, he didn't need anybody else for that, did he?
You know, I agree with just about everything you just said. I think there's cases to be made in both directions, and I think you just you made a case I don't disagree with. I've come to you know, I've grown kind of more cynical about Obama just since I wrote this book, and the way you put it is one reason. I don't understand why he hasn't used the bully pulpit more. I can't really tell you what the guy is thinking. I do know I have a couple of friends who are in the Treasury Department. And I do hassle them about why some of these decisions are made. And they feel, you know, the way Washington works is that you face the voters every 4 years or every 2 years, depending on your office. But the rest of the time, you face your very narrow constituency. And the guys you've talked to, these guys in Treasury talk to every day, are bankers. That's who they see as their constituency. And if the bankers are upset, the bankers cause problems for them, and the markets cause problems for them, and they need to stay on top of that. And there isn't a strong union movement in this country. There isn't a strong citizen reputation. The congressmen are all bought and paid for by the lobbyists to pay for their campaigns. And so there's just no counter pressure in the other direction. And so you're asking the president to take on a crusade in these areas and to take on any number of crusades at once, because, you know, environmentalists could say the same thing. The healthcare people could say the same thing. The immigration people could say the same thing. So I think the evidence is probably that Obama is a guy who, wherever he is, he plays ball.
Right.
He takes half a loaf. And he lost the opportunity to transform the system in such a way that that loaf would look a lot better. And he also lost the opportunity, although from what I can tell from the State of the Union, there were hints that he was returning. He was taking a more Reaganist posture on behalf of the values that he believes in, which is very encouraging, if true, if it's a symbol of things to come. But yeah, you know, it's complicated. You know, things are complicated. There's no one explanation for anything. I'm sure if we spent an hour hassling Obama about this stuff, he'd have some very compelling responses for why he did what he did in those circumstances. But the thing is, if he's going to be a progressive president, the system needs to be transformed, and a movement of progressive organizations needs to get its act together and to force those changes in the system that will allow such changes to go forward. Electing a president is not enough, and it's very complicated, very difficult business. The right did it. The right began with next to nothing. And over a period of about 40 years, built an incredibly powerful movement that is now the dominant force in American politics. The left has a harder job than the right does because the right has big business on its side. But it's possible. It's been done in the past. But tell you the truth, my experience with the left in this country is that it prefers to whine and complain and attack one another more than it.
How dare you say that? How dare you? I think to a certain extent, I mean, you're right. I mean, we need to have there needs to be more organizing on the left, and I think there needs to be
and more patience and more cooperation.
Right. And what would you say would be the one or two or three sort of focal points of reform that would be key to this?
Well, the left is losing a class war that's being fought against it and has been fought against it for a long time. You know, the inequality has gotten out of control in this country in large measure because of laws that were passed on behalf of rich people. And now it's about to get the conservatives are about to go after civil servants, policemen, firemen, teachers, and so forth, and their pensions. That's very clear. You know, if you look at why this is possible, the reason it's possible is because of the power of money in politics. So we need to focus on the power of money in politics. It's a very difficult fight because of the way the Supreme Court interprets the Constitution and gives corporations personhood. But I think that should be, for instance, a litmus test of a Supreme Court nominee, is that they disagree with that view. And a lot of organizing needs to be done so that we don't just turn our democracy over to rich people. I think it's a pretty simple concept. It's easier for people to organize on primary issues like their own personal health care, their own taxes, et cetera. But we need to show that the power of money has just gotten out of control in our politics, and it's costing people an awful lot in a lot of ways. You know, wage earners haven't seen a raise accounting for inflation in this country since the early 70s, whereas, you know, the top 1% has done just wonderfully. It's very simple once you get people to pay attention to it.
Eric Alterman, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And your phone actually started sounding good in the last 10 minutes. First 10 minutes were a little rough. Were you eating?
No.
Are you sure?
I wouldn't dare.
Are you serious?
That would be disrespectful.
Yes, he was eating. That's what it was. You were eating.
It's a lie, Sam. You're slandering me, and you're going to get a call from my lawyers.
Of that, I have no doubt.
And Sam, they're Jewish lawyers.
Of that, I have no doubt. I would be surprised if we don't have the same lawyers.
All righty.
All right. Thanks so much, Eric. Appreciate it.
Bye.
All right, folks, I apologize for the quality of the phone in the first 6-7 minutes. What are you going to do? Guy eats, right? That's what he was doing. It's clear because it started to sound fun. I think it's actually some type of, like, it's got to be some type of anxiety because just statistically speaking, it's impossible that he could be eating so much that he's always eating in the middle of interviews. I think he's nervous, and I think he eats probably when he's nervous. That's my guess. I'm going to ask him about that next time I see him. Stick around. When we come back on the other side, I'm going to read a great piece from the writer and historian Kevin Baker that is available nowhere. And it speaks to what Alterman was saying at the end of his. This is all coming together. All right, and you can IM me at Majority FM. Supposed to be. Don't you know which clothes even fit me? Come on and let me know. Should I cool it or should I blow? Wait a second, that's not pressure drop.
I played pressure drop going into it.
Ah, okay, fair enough. I'm a little discombobulated because I am going down to Washington, D.C. today for Families USA, and I'm hoping to do a live program tomorrow. Maybe we'll do it Friday. I'm not sure. I got to figure out how to work it. At the very least, I have interviewed Jane Hampshire, or I will have interviewed Jane Hampshire on the latest on Bradley Manning, and that case, very interesting stuff. And So we will have content tomorrow. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm going to this Families USA for Ring of Fire, and you know, I don't like to travel that much. You know, what are you going to do? So I want to play part of. We have more here than I want to play, but I want to play part of the way that Obama sort of opened up his speech. And, you know, Alterman was right. There were hints, and I think I mentioned this, there were hints of moments when he talked about regulation and when he talked about education and when he talked about health care. There were hints, not forceful, full-throated, explicit trumpeting of liberal values. But there were more explicit than his trumpeting of conservative values. I know that's a low bar, but you take what you can get. And but this part is really interesting. Let's play some of the audio from Obama as he's talking about Americans having. You know, he's sort of doing like, you know, there was a golden age. And we can get back to that age. And it's about education and et cetera, and innovation. Let's hear it.
Many people watching tonight can probably remember a time when finding a good job meant showing up at a nearby factory or a business downtown. You didn't always need a degree. And your competition was pretty much limited to your neighbors. If you worked hard, chances are you'd have a job for life, with a decent paycheck and good benefits and the occasional promotion. Maybe you'd even have the pride of seeing your kids work at the same company. That world has changed. And for many, the change has been painful. I've seen it in the shuttered windows of once booming factories, in the vacant storefronts on once busy main streets. I've heard it in the frustrations of Americans who've seen their paychecks dwindle or their jobs disappear. Proud men and women who feel like the rules have been changed in the middle of the game. They're right. The rules have changed. In a single generation, revolutions in technology have transformed the way we live, work, and do business. Steel mills that once needed 1,000 workers can now do the same work with 100. Today, just about any company can set up shop, hire workers, and sell their products wherever there's an internet connection. Meanwhile, nations like China and India realized that with some changes of their own, they could compete in this new world. And so they started educating their children earlier and longer, with greater emphasis on math and science. They're investing in research and new technologies. Just recently, China became the home to the world's largest private solar research facility and the world's fastest computer. So yes, the world has changed. The competition for jobs is real. But this shouldn't discourage us. It should challenge us. Remember, for all the hits we've taken these last few years, for all the naysayers predicting our decline, America still has the largest, most prosperous economy in the world. No workers are more productive than ours. No country has more successful companies or grants more patents to inventors and entrepreneurs. We're the home to the world's best colleges and universities, where more students come to study than any place on earth. What's more, we are the first nation to be founded for the sake of an idea. The idea that each of us deserves the chance to shape our own destiny. That's why centuries of pioneers and immigrants have risked everything to come here. That's why our students don't just memorize equations, but answer questions like, what do you think of that idea? What would you change about the world? What do you want to be when you grow up?
Okay, well, then he goes on to say, now it's our turn. We know what it takes to compete for jobs and industries of our time. We need to out-innovate, out-educate, and out-build the rest of the world. We have to make America the best place on earth to do business. We need to take responsibility for our deficit and reform our government. That's how our people will prosper. And Kevin Baker let me read some of this email. He says this narrative makes no sense on the face of it. This notion that Americans suddenly found themselves competing against the whole world, and that's been tough since our kids have gone from best educated to only ninth. But he goes on to say, we have the best innovators and the best colleges and universities. We still have the rest of the world in patents. All it will take is a little education, some social investment here and there, some strict budgeting, innovation. And he says, as well-intentioned though it may be, this whole narrative makes no sense on the face of it. So back in the good old days, we were the best at everything, but we did well only because we just had to compete against our neighbors? What? Were we the best or were we not? China and India sure did make changes. But of course, the Chinese had been, quote, teaching math since long before the rest of the world knew the Americas existed. And didn't India invent it? Which I think is true. I think our system is based on the Hindu numeric decimal system. Were the changes so much better in education, or the fact that the two countries emerged first from under Western thumbs and then from a suffocating systems of caste and communism over the course of the last couple of generations? That's a very good point. It's not a question of they've been educating necessarily. It's just that they have finally got a certain amount of ability to function. And Baker goes on to say, how did we fall behind? What Obama's pseudo-history conveniently ignores is that what really changed is not Chinese students buckling down to their algebra homework or, quote, sweeping technological changes in the course of a generation. What changed was government policy. American workers have always operated in times of rapid, sweeping technological change. They've always competed with other countries in one way or another, and they've generally done pretty well. The reasons they did well included the fact that for most of our history, our government protected our industries against competition from countries with desperately underpaid labor. He's talking about tariffs here. He's talking about non-free trade. And because the people running the industries kept inventing new stuff and plowing money back into their American industries instead of shipping their plants overseas and devoting all their time and capital to figuring out new financial Ponzi schemes. Look at GE. Look at GMAC. Both these companies, these major industrial companies, were massive shadow banks. Still, though, the old America that Barack Obama refers to used to be plagued by constant wrenching depressions. And those old industries didn't necessarily help make a good living or improve their children's standard of living. Being a steel worker or an auto line worker doesn't inherently pay well. In fact, for many decades, such jobs didn't pay much at all. Then the people who did them organized themselves and forced higher wages out of owners who at that time didn't have the option of searching out child slave laborers abroad. And elected representatives who defended and extended their rights. That's the, quote, magic formula that American prosperity came out of. Innovation, education, inventiveness, sure. But also industrial policy, unionism, protectionism, real patriotism, and all those other things that Obama and the whole lovely class he hails from don't want to hear about because they might chip away some small portion of their staggering wealth. That is the takeaway, ladies and gentlemen, that the magic formula that created American prosperity came, yes, from innovation and education and inventiveness, but also industrial policy, unionism, protectionism, and many things which would chip away at the extreme wealth in this country, concentrated in the hands of 1, 2, 3, 5% of the population. Baker goes on to say, we can make our kids do math problems until their fingers fray, and they still won't be able to compete with a sweatshop dictatorship where workers make 20 cents an hour. We can talk all we want about making social investments, and they will never be made as long as the financial oligarchy, which has severed all bonds of loyalty to this nation, continues to co-op and buy off our leaders. And he ends with, but hey, in the meantime, let's find common ground. Fire all the teachers. Which, of course, is much of what Obama's education program is designed to do in many respects. You know, so-called punish underperforming schools and cut their funding, which is supposedly going to make them work better. It's what the whole ideology behind this charter school movement is about. You know, it's one part, I think, delusion, the charter school movement, and one part ideological. The delusion comes from well-meaning people who see a couple of examples of successful schools because they're run on such a micro level. Yes, yes. And those schools are an asset to public schools because they give you ideas. They generate ideas and modes of operation. The fact of the matter is the vast majority of, or I should say not the vast majority, but more charter schools fail than public schools. And charter schools get sort of a free ride because they're using assets and resources of public schools. And it's one thing to operate one school. It's another to make sure that hundreds of thousands of schools are operating. And the idea with public education should be that as many kids get as good an education as possible. But in the end, Kevin Baker is absolutely right. We cannot do, we can maybe improve education. We can maybe provide tax incentives or research and development for certain industries. But we need a broader industrial policy. And we need a policy, essentially, that does not allow the concentration of wealth to the wealth to concentrate so intensely in such a small group of people. And we need laws that allow for people to organize without the specter of their economic security being wrenched away from them because they attempt to organize in such a way. That's what EFCA is all about. That's what the card check is all about. Allowing workers to organize easier. Instead, what we get is the demonization of unions. You know, it's one thing to get sold, you know, the notion of clean coal. It's another thing that the word foreclosure, when we are in the midst of perhaps the greatest foreclosure crisis this country has ever known, seems to be unabated. Apparently, if you don't talk about it long enough, it goes away. you know, there are some real problems that Obama is ignoring. But it was a speech. And I think, you know, the fact that Alterman doesn't watch it is in some ways instructive, both about Alterman, but also about the folly of expecting too much from a speech. I think a speech can be more problematic, frankly, than it can be helpful. And that speech was not terribly problematic, in my estimation. So the fight continues, and we attempt to reform our system so that, you know, I don't know if we could have ever gotten a different. I mean, look at the choices that we had. I was an Edwards fan, and all I can say is thank God. Thank God. My perspective did not prevail. But I don't see any reason to believe that Clinton was fundamentally different from Obama, was fundamentally different from Biden, was fundamentally different from Dodd. And Kucinich, yes, I appreciate most of his politics. I don't think that there's a tremendous amount of depth there to really, I mean, we needed a stronger progressive candidate. And I don't know where that person is going to come from. But I don't know if that person can win in the context of the system that we have now. But onwards and upwards, right, folks? So that's enough. It's sort of a bleak. You did put it.
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd. Lay, hoodlay, hoodlay.
Do something.
Loud was the voice of the lonely goat herd. Lay,
I don't know. How did things get so depressing? Alterman. It's because Alterman was eating so much during the interview.
Yeah, everybody here is pretty hungry.
Yeah. That's
probably
that's
what it is.
We all came in a little bit early today.
Well, not me. I feel pretty good.
Yeah, you already had a huge sub sandwich.
It was great.
Okay, let's go to the IM, shall we? Good morning, Sammy. Why the frick was CNN showing Bachman? I think I explained. Eric's connection, voice really hard to understand. It got better when he stopped eating. Will you be able to get to D.C. with the weather? Expecting 10 to 6, 10 inches? Yes, I take the train. If Eric is sucking on candy or anything, really, during the interview, don't tolerate it, Sam. Don't let it his fake, cocky, elitist nation attitude take over the majority report. We won't tolerate his disrespect. You need a particular mindset to appreciate Alterman, and I definitely do. I can't help it. War on the poor, the SOTU, State of the Union, it was very consistent. Apparently, we need to strengthen Social Security in a way which doesn't harm retirees, the disabled, but we have to cut Medicare and Medicaid, doing which would certainly hurt retirees and the disabled. We need to get off fossil fuels but expand coal and natural gas. We need to support programs like the DREAM Act, but expand crackdowns on immigrants, close corporate tax loopholes, and then lower corporate taxes. Ugh. Somehow we need, well, that's not so strange. It's talking about lower tax rates, just simplify the process for it to be net revenue. And now net revenue neutral, excuse me. That's not so strange. Of course, what will happen is the taxes will go lower and the loopholes won't be closed. Somehow we will make much needed investments in infrastructure, research, and education during a 5-year spending freeze. Even use democracy as a weird segue between a popular uprising in Tunisia and support for the U.S. military. Good point. Didn't mention Egypt, but, I mean, could you really expect them to? That would be not good. That wouldn't have been good for the people there either. Going on to say that we need to put military crews back on campuses and called the opposition to this divisive. But isn't this divisiveness what gives us such a robust democracy? Well, yes. I mean, yes. I think there were inconsistencies. I think he was, you know, depending on your perspective, giving with one hand, taking away with another, and a lot of it was just sort of, you know, feel good. That's why Piers Morgan on CNN was the best analyst they had.
And on Twitter, people were giving CNN so much crap for having him on there. It wasn't like...
Right. Meanwhile, Gergen is just and Gloria Borgia just spouting the greatest nonsense possible about the deficit and not enough to... What? What are you talking about? And the best moment of the whole night, I'm sorry, was after Bachman was done and coming back to Wolf Blitzer, who looked like he had just been hit in the head with a hammer. And you're just waiting. It's like, are you really not even going to say... We had some technical difficulties, and so he was looking into the wrong camera. They were so befuddled. They had no idea what to do.
The best part was, not the best part, but about the whole Bachman thing was before she even gave the speech, Eric Erickson said that
this
he'd
is
read
the
speeches.
This is the, yeah, of course, yeah. This is the...
The town hall guy who's...
Yeah, he's just said offensive things. He said, like, you know, David Souter is a goat fucker, he said.
Oh, yeah, he bloodshed because of...
Right.
If Roe v. Wade isn't overturned. Anyway, he said that he read all three speeches, and after Obama's speech was done, before Paul Ryan, he's like, I've read them all, and I got to tell you, Michelle Bachman's is the best one. It really just gets to the point, and, you know, it's short and all this kind of, like, stuff. And then they and then it actually happens, and people get to see it and not just, you know, hear it. And, you know, everybody – I felt like I wish I could be inside Eric Erickson's brain going, God.
Oh, he's just going, oh, boy, Rush is going to be proud of me. I'll get in front of that golden EIB mic soon enough. Oh, Rush. Donald Trump went on CNBC and complained that the president didn't speak about bankruptcy enough. Oh, the irony. America's biggest welfare queen complaining about Obama's not dishing out enough dough. Jimmy Reefer Cake, I disagree with the article you read. The essence of the comments about science, engineering, technology that Obama said are right on, speaking as someone who's proud to have engineering degrees. From two of the best schools in the country, I saw myself competing against kids from other countries who had better work ethic. And when he said the thing about holding teachers in high respect, it was gold. The respect of science is fundamental to solving many of our problems. He talked about moving from No Child Left Behind to a system that was built on the ground up. I get pissed when people put down Obama with no reason, but I still love you, man. Well, wait, now, Jimmy. First of all, the argument isn't that better education and inventiveness and this and that is wrong. No, yes, we need that. But the fact of the matter is that despite your going to having two engineering degrees, two of the best schools in the country, you are still at a fundamental disadvantage because of our government's policy in terms of limiting, of its trade practices, its union practices, whatnot. I mean, your wage is depressed because we don't have private unions in this country anymore. I'll have somebody on about the race to the top. You mentioned for-profit education yesterday. I heard that Steve Eisman, one of the guys who foresaw and made a killing off of collapsing mortgage-backed securities, is now touting a for-profit ed as the next such opportunity. You know, I heard something like that too. I got to look it up. Dactyl. Sam, can you post that Kevin Bacon article somewhere? I want to help disseminate it. Unfortunately, it's not an article. It's an email. I'll ask him if I can post it. It's an email he sent to me.
His name's really Kevin Bacon?
No, Baker.
Oh, I thought he said Kevin Bacon.
Oh, now. No, Kevin writes for, like, Harper's and Vanity Fair, and he's written at least three great books.
He's not quite Eric Alterman, but...
No, he hasn't written as many books as Eric Alterman.
Or worked at as many places.
Don't be punched. Actually, Sam, the economic model this country was built on was slavery. Now outsourcing to Chinese sweatshops is the closest approximation. Fair enough. Maxercise, after show names. Okay, The Overcast.
There's apparently like 50 comments on the post that was put up yesterday.
Oh, great. All right. I'll check it out on my post-erior. Why are you having the, why are they cryptic, though, like Overcast? Main shows suck cedar. Huh. Appendox. Apostate. Plotsum and fretsum. Hmm. Well, should I be surprised that this is coming from a guy with an IM name called Maxercise? Oh, Marxercise. Okay. Avant. This year, no Republican had the gall to stand up and yell. They all just run to Twitter. Mr. President, you don't believe in the Constitution. You believe in socialism. That's from Representative Paul Brown.
How about McCain getting up? He's like,
I am 45% convinced that he didn't know where he was. And we should all be thankful he didn't drop his fly and take a leak there. Didn't I come into the bathroom?
And what happened? Why wasn't he sitting right next to Joe Lieberman? It was like, how did he get stuck with John Kerry?
I don't know. They made up. Well, you know, he went to Kerry to ask to be his running mate. John Johns. How does Obama plan to hire 100,000 new teachers when there's a spending freeze? Look, you know, you can be all cynical. Do you remember that early Jake Gyllenhaal film, October Sky, about the kids in the 1950s aspiring to be rocket scientists as a response to Sputnik? That was the atmosphere back then. Science was cool. It was something conservatives believed in, and they believed in government. Infrastructure was a source of pride for conservatives. We had to look better than the Soviets. Now it feels like the only thing conservatives really care about is freedom to be as rich as humanly possible. And I think there's some validity in what you're saying, Zach. I think that's absolutely the case. Obama's State of the Union last night. The bygone days are gone and austerity is here. Beth, on Rachel's show, they talked about how Bachman and the camera angle, they said she was talking to a webcam and CNN had a separate camera feed. That's right. Kemi7, were you the one who comforted Marin after the Chevy Chase roast? So he called you my friend Sam, which I thought was sweet. No. What was the Chevy Chase roast?
I mean, he was roasted, but that was a while ago, I think.
Was it recent?
Maybe for the summer? Marin was on it.
I don't know what you're referring to. It's possible. I may have. I comforted Marin often. Jimmy Reed for cake. The president is really just an image, and I like what I heard from our figurehead. Respect teachers. Yes. I agree. I think I made that clear. All right, folks. We may cut it a little short today. I've got to get down to Washington. Why do you think Cenk makes Andy Kindler clutch his pearls like he does? Could it be that Cenk is unafraid to criticize Obama from the left? Cenk's like Glenn Greenwald. He doesn't give a fuck. You know, I don't know. Don't be a putz. You're what was it, Black Taco? Don't be a putz. I don't follow Andy's politics that much. But we'll see. Maybe he'll come on. Hey, Sam, I didn't watch State of the Union, but it sounds like Obama was in typical form. Sounds good and abstract to everyone because no one's sacred cows get cut. Considering that Social Security was the most likely target and Obama's backed off, I'll call it a win for now, but more depressing than a president with anti-progressive convictions is one that has no convictions at all. Well, I don't know if I agree with that last statement. And I will call it a win as well. You know, there was a time where I was like, you know, it's brilliant because he gets this political cachet. The problem is he never uses the political cachet for anything. At least Dems could rally around fighting Bush. Yeah. There's some validity to that. True, true, true. All right, folks, any more IMs? Majority FM. I'll take a couple more before I go. Pete Peterson, Eric Erickson, Dorsey-Dorsey-son. It's from Kyle. Pete Peterson, Atrios posted Pete Peterson's response to the State of the Union address. He blew off the embargo, which was pretty funny. Pete Peterson is that billionaire who's been gunning for Social Security for so long. I think Digby talked about him the first time she was on. And I had what I thought was a fairly clever tweet about, because the response came out so early today. Wonder if Pete Peterson makes Obama perform the speech for him personally. Like, come over to my house. Give me the speech this morning so I can sign off on this thing. Torresy, 80. The reason Bachman eyes looked off was because she was facing the internet camera for the Tea Party website. The CNN camera was lightly. Yes. I still believe one of the biggest problems in education is that many kids have trouble believing there's any real future for them that does not include a dead-end, low-paying job. It's much harder to apply yourself when you have no realistic goals to shoot for. I think there's some truth to that. I think I read a story very early when we launched about a foundation grant. It basically said to any kid who goes to this high school, you will have the money for college if you graduate with like a B or something. And their graduation with B rates shot through the moon. And so I think there's some real truth to that. Don't be a putz. Axel on MSNBC last night. Am I looking into the right camera? Yes, I saw it. What's up?
Oh, nothing.
Mark decides the Chase roast was years ago. Mark was fine. Chevy was not.
I just watched it.
Oh, you did? Kind of
funny.
Oh, what was the comforting that Mark needed?
I didn't hear him mention you.
What, on the roast?
Yeah.
No, he wouldn't have mentioned me on the roast.
I thought that's what they were saying. Oh, hey, breaking news. At the Majority Report recap, Avant has just posted a How to IM the Majority Report post.
Great.
Which is very nice. I'm sure he'll be putting it on the Majority FM site soon, but in the meantime, go to majorityreportrecap.tumblr.com.
There you go, folks. That's how you IM. A lot of people ask. I don't even know how to answer that question. How great was Boner's performance? You couldn't take his eyes off him. He was pretty good. He really just looked like he was falling apart, and then, you know, to watch him cry as soon as he's mentioned.
I kept saying on Twitter, I was just like, my reoccurring joke was he needed a cigarette. Really
I'll tell
bad.
You something. That to me... Can he really be that, like, emotional without any foreign substance? I mean, seriously. I mean, I am very emotionally detached in some respects. You know, there's some very narrow circumstances where I'm not. So I'm not necessarily a good, you know, person to judge. But, I mean, for people who are really emotional out there, I mean, just the fact that the president mentioned your name, and you know what? I'll tell you something. I bet you the Tea Party hated it. Watching him cry when because it's one thing when you make yourself cry, right? Talk about, but that he cried because Obama was mentioning him. Interesting.
Somebody said Bonaire looks like he could molt at any moment.
In 2005, an anonymous group of Kalamazoo residents began offering all high school graduates full tuition to any state college. I think that's right. That's right. That story. Exactly, Torsey. Torsey, not Dorsey. Boner can cry all he wants. He'll never upstage Joey the Shark. He's just too cool. Jimmy Reefer Cake. Loved Boner. That man needs a joint. Sammy, read Boner. I am hormonal, and even I am not that emotional. Let's see. All right. Okay, good time to end it. Tomorrow on the program, we will have Jane Hampshire will be here to talk about the latest on Bradley Manning. She was basically detained by some guards at Quantico. We will discuss that. And I'm not sure what the schedule will be for the next couple of days. We'll post something. Something will get posted. I'm not sure. I just don't know what it will be. And we may have a live show. We may not. Stay tuned. If we don't have a live show, I'll have the podcast posted in time for 11:30 so that we can deal with that then. All right, folks. Please, if you can, please become a Majority Report member. Please. Please. Talk to you soon. Get somehow lost.